My mom had two seed ticks on her hip, and my sister was there, and my sister pulled them off.
Amy's mom, Tammy, worked at a state park in central Missouri, which meant that finding a tick every now and again was pretty normal.
A couple days later, mom said she just wasn't feeling herself.
It turns out that these particular ticks carried a rare virus that ended up being deadly, which is awful and scary because getting a tick bite is such a common thing this time of year if you do anything outdoors. Now, experts suspect that the bourbon virus, which is getting a lot of attention in Missouri, probably isn't lethal in all cases or even necessarily most cases. But still, is there something we should know about this icky little pest lurking in our woods? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm joined by Greg Berg, an entomologist from KU's biology department. Hi, Greg.
Hi.
You study ticks.
How are you doing?
I'm good, but I don't know how you can stand to study ticks.
So I think the reason that I'm interested in studying ticks is because it's kind of a fascinating organism in terms of their life cycle, what they do, and what they can't do.
What can't they do?
So they can't fly. They can't run and jump. They can't live off of anything other than blood. And so they are really very restricted in the kinds of things that they can do.
So they, like, jump onto us from tree branches?
No. They actually, maybe the better term would be they hunt. So they climb up on low-hanging vegetation, usually grasses, and they grab a hold of us as we walk by.
It's, you know, I want to kind of travel back in time with you to your first encounter with a tick. I don't know if you remember it. I remember mine for sure.
Actually, I do. It was when I was a kid, and just like what we heard earlier, I was out messing around in the woods with my friends and went home, and mom was checking, and she found a tick on me. And I was like, ew.
Yeah, because did you feel like that hard bump?
You know, I don't recall realizing it was there at all. All I know is mom found it, she pulled it off, dad took it out in the driveway and stomped on it.
Just to be sure.
Yes, I think.
I have taken some just to be sure measures of my own. If you use a bottle cap full of nail polish remover and you can watch the little legs wiggle until they stop. That's mm-hmm. my technique.
So, and that's when they're attached?
After they're attached, just to be sure.
Just
you don't
want to
let
sure
it loose again.
Right. So, you know, when you do that, the chances of introducing some kind of infection increases because you're irritating the critter while it's attached, and that's probably not a good thing.
Okay. Well, so Slate Magazine is calling this year the year of the tick. Do you think there is something special about this year?
I would say no, generally. I do think that there are certain parts of the country where the conditions are right for ticks to emerge in large numbers, and that those kind of conditions will cycle. So it might be this year, it might be not next year, it might be 5 years from now, but there are certain environmental conditions and ecological conditions that give rise to larger numbers of ticks in a given year.
Like what?
So there's some really cool studies that have been done by some researchers on the East Coast where they've actually been able to link the increasing number of acorns that are produced by oak trees in 1 year to higher numbers of Lyme disease cases 2 years later.
Does higher numbers of Lyme disease cases necessarily mean higher numbers of ticks?
Not entirely, no. So in some cases, more individuals might be out in the woods coming in contact with ticks, but if populations of ticks are larger, then the likelihood of individuals getting in contact with one, it does increase.
So help me understand, you know, most of us know ticks through two things. The kind of encounter you just described from your childhood where a tick has ended up attached to your skin and has to be removed. And it's kind of like, I don't know, it can be sort of dramatic. And then from news about tick-borne illnesses. Those are the two contexts that most of us know about ticks from. But you supposedly, I mean, I would suspect you know about more. There's more to the tick than this?
Well, I would think so. I would hope so. I spent a lot of time doing this. But I think one of the important points is with regard to the second comment you made about ticks carrying disease. I think oftentimes people would say, well, if it's a tick, it carries the disease. It's infected. But I would venture to guess that most of the ticks that we come in contact with are not infected with a particular pathogen. So the number of ticks in a population that are actually infected that could transmit a disease to someone else, it could be relatively low.
How do researchers know whether it's a big threat or a small threat?
Most of that would come from collecting ticks in the field and examining them for the presence of pathogens.
So it has to be already an understood pathogen, though, that people have been infected with and that's been studied so that it could be recognized, right?
Yes, yes. And I guess the other thing which would be interesting to note is that ticks are very good at carrying all sorts of symbiotic pathogens or symbiotic bacteria and microorganisms. So
what does that mean?
That means a microorganism like a bacteria that is not a pathogen. So it just
so that's not dangerous.
Exactly. And so ticks are very good at carrying those kinds of organisms. So what scientists need to do is distinguish between organisms that might be inside of a tick that is not dangerous and non-pathogenic versus one that might be pathogenic.
I mean, my feelings about ticks are not warm and fuzzy. And I suspect that a lot of people feel the same. I feel like I hear in some of what you've said about that you study the tick because of what it can do and what it can't do. And this idea that the tick can't fly, can't survive off of anything but blood. Like, there might be a hint of admiration for the tick's resourcefulness.
Yes, I would say so. So most of the common ticks that we come in contact with have two-year life cycles. So from the time the eggs are laid until a female in that generation lays her eggs, it might be 2 years later. And during that time period, there are three life stages, and each one of those life stages feeds one time on a host. So over 2 years, they feed three times, and the total amount of feeding that they may actually engage in.
And when you say feeding, you are talking about sucking people's blood or
correct.
Deer or dogs or something.
Correct, correct, yes. So they're attached to a host and they're sucking blood. And I would say the length of time that all three of those life stages feed, adding them up, would be somewhere around 2 weeks. So if you think about a generation that lasts for 2 years and the time in which they are actually physically feeding takes place in less than 2 weeks or so, that's awfully amazing. So what you're talking about is an organism that I've seen in the literature referred to as a gorging fasting organism. So it gorges and it spends a significant amount of time not feeding. And I just think that's pretty fascinating.
How do they do that?
I'm not sure I know how to answer that question.
Is that still a mystery, like how they can survive on...
Well, so they basically sequester their blood meal, and they draw on that during the times that they're looking for another host.
How hard do they have to look for a host?
Well,
because it's hard not to anthropomorphize. I mean, so now that you're talking about this, imagine a tick sitting in the woods I mean, not with binoculars, but kind of close, like spying, waiting for an unsuspecting person who hasn't put on bug spray and short sleeves and, you know, like, it can't be like that, can it?
Well, I don't think they make binoculars that small.
Right, but minus the binoculars.
So you really, if you want to think about it in terms of what they are attempting to do, they're not very good at traveling any great distances, but they do have the capacity to monitor their environment and sense the presence of certain volatiles like carbon dioxide. So they can move to areas where animals are more likely to be found than not. And their job then is to climb up on vegetation and wait. And if something comes by, they're successful. If something does not come by, they're not.
So how do you recommend that people who, you know, presumably we don't all want to live our lives indoors for fear of getting a tick in the summertime, I mean, how do you recommend people adapt to the knowledge that ticks are out there and they're going to climb up on you if they can?
Right. So I think what is sort of the common wisdom in terms of going out in the woods, going out in the field, and protecting against ticks, it may not look the best, may not be the most comfortable, but wearing long, light-colored pants.
Light-colored? Why?
Light-colored so that you can see them.
Oh, I see.
Before they attach. And also I always wear sort of tube socks, athletic socks, and tuck the pants in the socks. And that way, as you're walking, you can actually look down periodically and you can see them climbing up on your leg and you can flick them off.
Do you have to make the case to people that not getting a tick is more important than not looking super dorky?
If people are concerned about the risk of contracting a tick-borne disease, then I would say look dorky.
Yeah. I mean, it is scary. I don't mean to make light of it because it's, you know, we've heard that although it's rare for a tick bite to be deadly, it can be.
Correct. And the other part of the protection is if one has been out walking around in tick habitat and they get home, one of the things they can do is check themselves, like my mother did when I was little, check each other for the presence of ticks and remove them as promptly as possible.
Why does it matter how quickly you remove them? Is there something that can't happen if you get it off pretty quickly?
Right. So that's what I was going to say. One of the things that we do understand is it takes a period of time for a tick to be physically feeding before it can transmit a pathogen. I think that Rocky Mountain spotted fever, the tick needs to feed for roughly 24 hours. For Lyme disease, it's likely to be 2 days. So if you get the tick off before then, the risk of if the pathogen is present, the risk of transmission will drop considerably.
Is there something in the course of time that you have spent studying ticks that has really surprised you?
I would guess the one thing is their survivability. The fact that you can put them in a jar and put them in your lab or in your, actually you can put them in your kitchen if you like. My wife wouldn't approve of that. But And they will live for months and months and months without feeding.
That you present that like it's a good thing, and for the tick, I suppose it is. But I think most people would see the survival of the tick that's been on their person as not a goal.
Right, that's right. And so the interesting thing is the reason that they do so well in surviving for that 2-year life cycle is the fact that they can live for a long period of time without feeding. That to me is pretty fascinating. The other thing that I think is pretty interesting too is for ticks to live for a long period of time, their environment needs to be optimal. And by optimal, it needs to have a very high level of humidity. So if someone brought a tick into their house and say it fell off of their jeans, and that tick crawled into the carpet somewhere, if the tick didn't get into anything, it would probably die within a week.
A week is a pretty long time.
Yeah, but it's not a year.
Any final piece of advice you want to give, particularly Missouri residents who might be hearing this very scary tick news and needing some sense that there's something they can do to either prevent this or manage it?
Well, I think repeating this idea of being very careful when you're in the woods, and checking regularly for the presence of ticks and removing them when they're found, if they're found, is just a very good strategy. And also knowing that most likely the ticks that we come in contact with are not carrying a pathogen. Yes, some of them are, but not all of them.
Greg Berg, thanks for giving us the scoop on ticks. I still hate them.
That's fine.
Greg joined us from KU's biology department. Up next, Lawrence's recent hire of an African-American police chief is a first, or at least a first in more than 100 years. The story of Lawrence's black chief marshal who served in the 1890s. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And I'm joined by Chris Mulvinen, the Lawrence Police Department's historian, which is a job I did not know existed. He's here to tell us about Lawrence's first African-American police chief. It turns out that's not the recently hired Gregory Burns Jr., as many thought. Chief Burns is the first in 100-plus years, which is a big deal. But Chris Mulvinen, who was the first?
Well, good morning. And first, just let me thank you for the invite.
Well, thanks for being here.
You bet. Our first African-American police chief slash city marshal was Sam Jeans, and started out as an officer and then was a city marshal back. And the best we have from a date time span for his years of service was approximately 1890 to 1900, so about 10 years or so, 10 to 12 years.
How did you find out about Samuel Jeans?
Well, as the historian for the department, let me give you just a little bit of background. When I first started here, there was a couple other officers, two lieutenants at the time, who kind of co-shared historian duties. And they had handed me a shoebox with a few items in it and a cigar box. And I still have both of those boxes. And that was just about it on the history. So I set out in the time that I had to do the research that I could to kind of research what the different, or rather who the different people were who served, because people just didn't keep records back before 1950, let's say, about who served here and when. So I've done everything that I can, and I still do a little bit here and there. It's tough within other duties, but you know, you have to just go back and just start digging in the newspapers and online when you can now, because that stuff's available, and then spend time down at the Watkins Museum in Lawrence when the time allows to dig up who served and when they served.
Why do you do it? Why is it important to know the history within the police department?
Well, it's really disheartening that it was never preserved, and it's just not preserved. It just wasn't that it was not preserved for an African American named Sam Jeans, but I mean for white officers or Hispanic officers who served here then. Why it wasn't kept, I don't know. I have no idea. Nobody's been able to give me a decent answer on that. The simple fact is that it wasn't. I've always been a history buff. When I was asked to do historical duties for the department, I enthusiastically said yes, and so I've been more of a clearinghouse. I've been more of just the collector of everything that I can get my hands on, is just to try to build a history from when I started, which was back in 1988, backwards from there. And so I've contacted family members of former officers, and family members have contacted me, and we share information. And I collect what I can, and it's important to see who served, and then to be able to get a good presence that current day officers can look at and say, man, there have been 400 or whatever the number is people who served before me, and things really haven't changed. And that they were placeholders just as the same as I'm a placeholder. And we're going to do our best to serve the citizens of our community. And so I think it's great to show that way back when that the police officers were just as much involved in the community as we are today.
Tell me what you know about Samuel Gene, or Samuel Genes, I should say.
And Gene, yeah. He was extremely well thought of within the city of Lawrence and within the law enforcement community. I've uncovered one story that said in his obituary that he possessed the confidence to the public to a remarkable degree, and I'm quoting here. The people who stood for law and order believed him to be, and the others who knew him feared him. He seemed to have a natural faculty of detecting crime. Criminals told more of him and about him than they did other officers. Crooks had an idea that he could see through them, and they seldom tried to deceive him and never succeeded. He was a true detective officer, and that was what made Sam the strongest.
So he was sort of respected within the law-abiding community and feared beyond that.
And well respected within the community as well. There were several newspapers in Lawrence at that time. There was a daily, there was an evening newspaper and a weekly newspaper. And all the editorials, even though they were written by different people, they were highly, highly complimentary of Marshall and Chief Genes.
Is that unusual when you look at the history of chiefs of police and chief marshals?
I think in this case it may have been a little bit to a degree, just because I think he commanded a lot of respect for whatever reason, and others did too. But it's just it seems to be unique to him that he was so highly thought of over that broad spectrum.
So being the first African-American to fill that position and to do that in the 19th century, I am sort of torn about whether to find that surprising, because it's a long time ago for that first to have occurred. It's long before the civil rights movement. At the same time, Lawrence has this free state history that it's so proud of.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that may have played a part in it. To what degree, I wouldn't be able to venture a guess, but I'm sure to some extent that there was a kick or a bounce from that as well.
There are a lot of reasons why people are talking about that the recently hired police chief is the first African American to hold that position in more than 100 years. That's a big deal to a lot of people in the community, particularly in the context of news over the past, 5 years in particular, that about tensions between police departments and communities and communities of color. I wonder if that same conversation was something that people talked about in the 19th century.
Probably so. I would assume more so maybe in Lawrence, just because of the abolitionist history that Lawrence had, and being the groundswell of the free state movement here in the Midwest. Lawrence's history, it's so rich and it's so in depth and diverse that I'm sure that some of the same conversations that we're having today probably took place back then, because Lawrence was not a perfect town then as well.
When you read some of the articles and the editorials about Sam Genes, what stands out? Like, are there incidents or accomplishments that stand out to you having read all of those?
Again, that he was so highly respected, there's one little quote from it looked like a woodcut drawing of Sam, a portrait that was taken from a photograph of him, where he's got on the old style bobby, kind of like the New England or the England bobby police would wear, the rounded tall hat. And it says, "Our new marshal." So it's the World's Portrait Gallery today, which is talking about the journal World, shows Sam Genes, the present city marshal. He says he's fearless in danger, but has a good judgment and knows how to get along with the general public. His record is quite free from mistakes, and most of his cases stick. The Hotel de Calaboose, which is under his management, is doing quite a flourishing business and has no vacant rooms, which proves that the marshal must be a good landlord.
He ran a hotel?
Well, I'm thinking that was what they called the jail at the time.
Ah.
So it was the Hotel de Calaboose, and I had to Google it this morning. I've heard the term Calaboose for quite a few years, but I really wasn't sure what the term was, but it refers to a prison or a local jail.
So, not an upscale B&B.
Oh, I wouldn't think so, no. I think it was there that they pushed all the troublemakers, and again, public intoxication was a major crime back then, so they had what they referred to as a drunk tank. So I'm sure that that quite often that the people who were housed there were somewhat intoxicated.
Are you aware of any material that quotes this first African-American police chief and chief marshal in Lawrence that quotes him, you know, shares his viewpoint, his thoughts in his own voice?
No, and I'm sure that there's some stuff out there. It's just getting down into the files at either the Spencer Museum up on campus or the Watkins Museum downtown Lawrence and just, you know, spending hours upon hours just digging it out. And I'm sure there's something there. There's a huge gap in the names of people who served and when they served as far as marshals go. There's a huge gap in photographs. There's some plenty of other people who served as town marshal and chief of police that photos don't exist. And these people were instrumental in the founding of Lawrence, and they were instrumental in the Free State Movement. They were instrumental in the Underground Railroad.
How so, though? Can you explain that?
Well, it was the first immigrant aid. There were two or three different immigrant aid companies that came through this area back in the early 1850s. They decided to settle in Lawrence because they liked the river bottom ground. They liked the access to the river. They liked the high point that Mount Oread presented to them. And so some of those early founders were from the New England Immigrant Aid Society, and they were abolitionists. They were strongly opposed to slavery. And so when they first landed here, they divvied up divided duties. They voted somebody in as city clerk, somebody as city marshal, somebody as city engineers. They all assumed different positions. And from that point on, approximately every year or so, some of those positions changed to different people. And so those people were the first. For example, one of the first city marshals was a guy's name by Joel Grover. Joel ran a station in the Underground Railroad at a barn that is still standing here in town.
So police in Lawrence were helping slaves escape?
You could maybe make that argument. I'm not sure if he was actually city marshal at the time, but you know, he was involved in it, as were others.
Who do people in the community come to you with questions about previous officers, marshals, chiefs? I mean, does it matter, do you think, to the like average citizen who filled these roles?
Sometimes it does. I get a lot of inquiries from not citizens, but from family members. You know, I'll get a phone call or an email from somebody that said, I believe my uncle was a police officer here for a while, or grandpa or great grandpa, you know, can you help me out? And, it's sometimes the name I'll recognize it. Sometimes I don't. I have very limited files here where I can go back and try to look stuff up. And I'm always open to talking with anybody about that and trying to help them out. I'll ask for copies of anything they have, and we'll trade stuff back and forth. I'll copy stuff that I have that pertains to them if it so works out that way. So I'll get maybe half a dozen inquiries over the case of a year.
If it's mostly people with sort of a family curiosity more than a civic curiosity, perhaps, I mean, do you think that more people should be interested from a civic standpoint in who filled these roles?
Well, you know, I don't know. That's a good question. I would like to see more interest in it. But then again, I can understand it. I have a couple of nephews that my wife and I help raise every once in a while on the weekends. We take them from mom and dad, and they're in their 30s now. They're just not all that interested in history. Not yet, anyway. I'm hoping to, you know, in the next 10 or 15 years that they'll kind of grow into that. So it may be a generational thing that you're not going to get that much interest in anybody under the age of, say, 40. And I hate to make a generalization, but that has seemed to be the case, that most of the people who contact me and are looking for information are in their late 40s and 50s.
For a first, like, you know, the recently hired chief of police, people consider that a first in many ways because it has been so long since the last African-American chief of police. And now I think there's some acknowledgement that that matters. As someone who studied this history, why do you think it matters, or do you?
Oh, I think it does. It definitely does. Chief Burns is going to bring a new perspective, a new set of eyes. He has his own life experiences. As he said at the introductory ceremony when they had all four candidates here, you know, he was surprised to be where he was because of how he grew up. And he was very grateful that he had the opportunities that he had. But, you know, that echoes a lot of people's background, black or white, Hispanic or whatever anybody's ethnicity is. You know, we take all kinds at the police department. We try to be as diverse as we can, and I think that he would bring a brand new perspective, and it'll help improve community relations, and that's something that we're constantly trying to do. And that's not to say that community relations are bad in Lawrence, but they can certainly improve in any community with the interaction between the police and the citizens. And we're on board with that 100%.
Chris Mulvinen with us from the Lawrence Police Department. Thanks so much for sharing the story of Samuel Jeans.
Great. I'm glad. Thank you very much.
Up next, a new zine in Kansas City and the community it serves. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now there's a new zine in town that shines a spotlight on LGBTQ musicians telling their stories and doing Q&As with the personalities. It's called Hear Queer, and it was started by Anna Sell, who's with me now. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
What inspired you to start this?
That's a really good question. It kind of came from a few different places. One being someone who's very, very into music and loves the way that music kind of informs self-identity, and also being someone who's queer. I felt like there was a void in that space for dialogue about queer musicians, and that's something that I felt for a while. But then also coming out of, you know, a lot of the political turmoil in the last year and seeing the way that a lot of queer people in the country are hurting, especially in our community, it felt like the right time to try to do something that would be very positive and uplifting. And that was where we came up with the idea to create this publication and donate a portion of our profits to organizations that are working with LGBTQ youth and things like trans suicide prevention and things like that.
Who's we?
We have a small team. It's predominantly myself and a friend of mine named Bill, who wasn't able to join us this morning. But we've been working together on this concept and developing it over the last 6 to 7 months. And then we brought on a designer named Kevin, who has done beautiful work and translated, you know, our ideas into something that's like physical and holdable. And that's something we're very appreciative of because neither of us are designers at all.
You mentioned that it was important to you to think about how music informs identity. And mm-hmm. I'm curious about what music did that for you and how. Can you tell some of those stories?
Sure. That's a really good question. I actually last night was at the Fleet Foxes show here in Kansas City, and I was thinking a lot about that was music that I listened to a lot when I was younger.
Tell us about that band.
Yeah. So that isn't, you know, necessarily even a band that is queer identifying in any way, but the music is so transcendent and so much about like the nature of life and the movement through life. So that was something that I was feeling like last night, actually, while I was watching that live for the first time since I was, I think the last time I saw them, I was 17. And I also thought a lot about the transformation I've had between being a 17-year-old who is heavily closeted and not very comfortable with my identity to now being 24 and very much embracing of who I am and doing something.
Do you think
something.
That music had something to do with that?
I think all music has had something to do with that. And that's why I focus so heavily on music in my writing and in my interest areas. And that's the beauty of music is that it helps tell a story that you might have in your own head, but not feel like you have the words to put to it, right? And that's, again, like circling back to why we wanted to really highlight those musicians that are telling the stories of being queer and not even necessarily so overtly as making every song about their queer identity, but being a queer person who's living in this world and writing music and making that accessible to other people.
Do you think it matters, and do you think it should matter, whether a performer is gay, straight, bi, or whatever?
I think that it matters as long as we as a society make it matter, and that, like, it is, you know, we've seen a lot of progress in how queer identifying people are accepted by our society and our community, but it's still something that is marginalizing in a sense. So to be openly and proudly identifying with the LGBTQIA plus community is a strong stance to take. You know, I've heard people say this, and I agree with it, that to be openly queer in today's day and age is in and of itself like an act of revolt against some of the status quo that keeps us from feeling like equals in the society. So to go on stage and to say, I am this and I am proud to be this, it's very powerful to someone who's younger and listening and hears that message.
So speaking of that, I mean, the language that you use might mm-hmm. be surprising to some people. I mean, it's been going on for a while, the mm-hmm. sort of taking back of the word queer. But can mm-hmm. you talk about the choice to use that word?
Sure. That's also a good question. So I've heard a lot of people have asked about that and said, you know, isn't this a word that is hateful or hurtful? And to me, it's not. I really like the word queer because in my mind, it's all encompassing of all identities that fall outside of, you know, the norm, the heteronormative. And the term queer doesn't have roots in being a negative term. It means just something different, you know, and something outside of what is normal. So that's why I wanted to use that term specifically, because I wanted it to feel like an encompassing word. And then also for the roots that it has with the Stonewall riots and the chants, you know, we're here, we're queer, get used to it. We kind of, the name of the zine has a play on words with that, because it's spelled H-E-A-R, like you're hearing music, but if you hear it, you think back to that terminology.
What is it, I want to get back into this question about mm-hmm. the importance of music
sure.
in the kind of personal journey you've described having, and that, mm-hmm. I mean, I guess you probably imagine that the audience for your zine has also shared.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about music that makes it an interesting space to look at crossing over with the queer community?
Sure. I think that something that music does and provides is that, and there are other art forms that do this as well, but music has this space where it can be both very counterculture and also mainstream at the same time. And musicians can float back and forth between being very counterculture and mainstream. And other artists can do that as well. Writers do that a little bit. You see it a little bit less so in the visual arts. But music is very accessible, especially today. You know, it's very easy to find music online, to be introduced to new musicians through that, through the internet. And so the idea is, you know, someone who's in like a less mainstream place as a musician can easily be discovered and found by someone who is looking for that and searching for that. I think that was a kind of a roundabout answer to that question. But.
Oh, no. I mean, tell me about some of the bands or performers you've been most excited to get to know through this project.
Thanks for asking that question, because I really like talking about those artists. So I got to spend a little bit of time speaking with Erica Joy, who I've kind of had, you know, incidental contact with here and there. We've tangentially known each other, but we've never had like an opportunity to really talk about ourselves and our identities together, and we have a lot in common in that area. And
like
that,
what?
And as to say, in that we are both, you know, we identify as female. We're both queer identifying, but we definitely have a more like non-binary understanding of ourselves and gender in general. And that though I consider myself a woman and like present in that way, I don't think of gender as a very like black and white binary, and see myself leaning towards what some would consider more masculine tendencies as well. And she is in the same boat. And so we talked about that, how like we don't necessarily think of ourselves outside of the norm in terms of pronouns and like that kind of gendering of ourselves, but we don't think of ourselves in the same way that traditional gender standards would.
Your Q&A with Rachel Mallon about mm-hmm. attending Pride was touching to me. I mean, it sort of focused a little bit on how important it was to her to attend Pride as someone who was out, because the previous time she'd been, she hadn't publicly acknowledged her interest in women.
Mm-hmm.
Did that story surprise you?
No, it didn't surprise me, because I think that's a story that a lot of people share, and that I myself was the same, and that I participated in that, you know, event quite a few times before I was able to actually feel comfortable coming out myself. And I think that's true of a lot of people. You kind of like start to hear the stories and feel comfortable with the community before you might be at a point where you're welcoming yourself to say, I am queer, I am gay, I am whatever that identity might be for yourself.
Who do you see as the audience for your zine?
I see predominantly the Kansas City community as the audience for the zine here.
Like the general Kansas City community?
No, I would hone it down a little bit more to like the music community and hopefully the queer community as well. I like that there is an audience here beyond queer members of the Kansas City community. I've had people who are not queer identifying ask me about it and want to get more involved in helping spread the word about it, which is really encouraging to me because it feels like we have a good support system throughout the city.
I want to get back to this question about whether and how it matters how a person identifies,
sure.
either in terms of gender or sexual identity, as far as their role as a musician in a
mm-hmm.
larger community. Do you think that there is a risk of, you mentioned marginalizing, like that people get kind of pigeonholed and maybe that the general community forgets that this is a musician, period.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I think there is a fear of that more than that actually happens. And I don't know if that's coming from like the cultural context of, you know, everyone seeing Tegan and Sarah as a certain way or Melissa Etheridge as a certain way. And now being like an artist in 2017, where our understandings of identity are shifting and people are more accepting and more open about who they are. I think that's shifting in a different direction. And I like that. I like that. I know more musicians who are just kind of like, I'm queer and I'm going to play music for you now. Like, I'm going to write songs and that's what I'm going to do. And people don't seem to be as interested in like honing in on this one specific part of their identity and making everything that they do about that.
Is there an upcoming show that you are really looking forward to in Kansas City or the Kansas City area?
I'm trying to think. I actually just attended a show this last weekend that I was really excited about, which was
yeah.
the Julian Baker show in Lawrence, Kansas. And I know she's touring around the Midwest a little bit right now.
Tell us who she is.
Julian Baker is a phenomenal musician. She is really like a presence in and of herself on stage. So she works mostly with her guitar and like piano and does a little bit of looping, but it's really just her on stage. And she's a singer-songwriter with an incredible talent for conveying what are very difficult things about yourself to convey, like fear and loneliness and kind of some of like the melancholic thoughts that a lot of us experience. and I was really excited about that show because I wanted to see her play for a long time, and it's the first show that we were able to cover like a live review and photo gallery for our website as Here Queer. And I actually ran into her on the street before the show and introduced myself, and she knew of the publication and was excited for us to be covering it. So that was like a really cool groundbreaking moment for us, and that it feels like we're having some momentum and moving forward.
Does having a zine make a community sort of identifiable or concrete in some way? I guess, I mean, it's going to be true that there are like LGBTQ members of any music show audience
mm-hmm.
and that there are going to be performers who identify that way. But that once there's this thing that everybody reads and talks about, that maybe there's some sort of like, I don't know, clarity around the idea that this is a community.
Sure. I hope that a lot of the community will read and engage with this, but I know that we have a long way to go in terms of opening up this project and making it as inclusive as possible to people that we haven't even met yet. So my hope is that at some point it does become something that a lot of people in the Kansas City community, especially in that intersection of the queer community and the music community, feel comfortable in engaging in and participating with. So I think that there is some sense to that, that it does help that feel like a tangible experience. But at the same time, we're working towards making sure everyone is included in that experience as best as we can.
How did you get into music?
I just have always really, really loved music. As a kid, I listened to a lot of music and went to a lot of shows. And then after I graduated from college, I interned with The Record Machine, which is a local record label, and I continue to work with them. But that's kind of how I got into the music community in Kansas City. And from there, have just met more and more people and gotten involved in other ways as well.
They say that writing about music is like dancing about architecture or something along those lines. Do you find that to be true?
I think so. But I think what that kind of phrase is hinting at in a way is that like art can transcend boundaries, and you can use one form of art to connect to or express another form of art. I think when people use that phrase, they're using it almost in a way to like knock music writers, in that like, how are you going to write about something that's not a written experience?
Yeah, why not just listen to it?
Right.
But why not just listen to it?
I think that writing about music helps people to discover new music that they might not have otherwise come across. I think that's a big part of why music writing exists. And also in these moments with like the Q&As that we do, it gives artists a more human and tangible feel. Like if you're only ever listening to an artist's music and you don't ever read about who they are as a person, like you only get this one side of them, and that's the side of them that's recorded and shared that way. But these are whole people, and their music is not going to necessarily express every part of themselves. And sometimes that's all a musician wants people to know, is their recorded music. But sometimes musicians are open to having more of themselves shared with the public.
Is there something that you would like to see change in Kansas City's music community?
I think that I would like to see more of an openness and awareness to others, and that there are senses, there are times where it feels like we could be more inclusive of people who are othered from us.
Wait, can you give me an example maybe of what you're talking about?
Sure. So I think like when I see a lot of, I feel like, sorry, I'm trying to find the right words to express this. I think that sometimes, like recently there was a festival that had specifically like an LGBTQ stage at the festival, which is great and encouraging, and that there's an awareness that there are those musicians who need and deserve a space. But I would love to see that as just musicians playing at the festival, if that makes sense. And that they're just embedded directly into like the lineup. And maybe there's like another extra event outside of the rest of the festival that celebrates that diversity. But do you understand what
I'm
saying
there?
Yeah,
it's a fine line, isn't it, between sort of making something part of the mainstream and acknowledging that there might be a specific community with its own needs and desires and, you know, urge to connect.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's a fine line that we're walking here as well as the publication.
Is there, who was the first musician you covered when you started Hear Queer?
I think, well, we've only had the one issue out, so everyone in that issue of the zine is of the first, but I think the first person that I talked to was Erica Joy.
And what you liked about that experience was that you two had so much in common. Was there someone you interviewed where your eyes were opened to a whole different kind of experience than the one that you had?
Well, I think in that interview with Rachel Mallon, she is queer identifying in a different way from me, in that she doesn't really factor gender into the equation when it comes to like romantic preference. She just sees people and wants to date people who are interesting to her. So that's a very different experience from me, because I am more interested in one gender. So that was an interesting way to think about things.
Do you think that there's a chance that this publication would ever branch out beyond the music community?
I think what we're focusing on is the music community specifically. But I think that there's always ways for projects to grow. So we'll be interested to see how that changes.
Our time is up. Anna Selly, where can people find Hear Queer?
You can find us online at hear-queer.com. You can also find us at Wonder Fair in Lawrence. We're selling there currently.
Hear Queer is a new zine by and for Kansas City's LGBTQIA music community, And that's it for today. You can find all of today's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it all for you by the end of the day. And you can also find yesterday's conversation about public high school options in Kansas City, Missouri. Tomorrow, an investigative project by NPR and ProPublica has raised questions about maternal care in the United States. As infant mortality declines, maternal deaths are on the rise. Let's take a look at the situation in Kansas City tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. With lots of help from intern Danielle Hogarty, I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date is next.